Okay, is this everybody? Is like, all right, well, I guess I can start now. Yeah, I'm Echo, and my speech is like going to be about battlefield technology, like where it's going to go, and it's too much technology on the battlefield, a bad thing. It's going to hamper the ground forces, and where did it start from? That's like what I'm going to focus on for the most part. It's going to be like an open discussion, so if you have anything to add, just go ahead and butt in. I've got, some pictures and stuff that I'll probably use, but I was going to do, like, a PowerPoint or something, but I didn't want to buy a Microsoft product and run it on my Mac. So, all right, so I guess I'll start now. And all right, well, yeah, I don't know. I'm going to do this. Anyway, basically, my theory is that most battlefield technology is a direct result of the Second World War. Just because of the fact that the Second World War was like the first real race for technology. When you look at the Second World War, World War II, you basically the first thing you think about is probably the atomic bomb. Which is probably one of the largest military adventures. It basically changed the way the world is run. Without World War II, you wouldn't have the Cold War and the nuclear arms race. Also, another big factor is the V-2, the German vengeance weapon. It was basically the first ICBM, and the V-1 was also made by the Germans. It's almost like a cruise missile. It was had a pulse jet engine. Anybody familiar with that at all? Yeah, yeah. The V-2 was actually it was supersonic, I believe. So basically, if you were like in London, you wouldn't hear it. All you would hear was a loud bang afterwards and big explosion. Yeah, I don't think it was guided. I think it just had gyros, and when it took off, I'm not sure what the altitude it climbed up to, but I don't know how fast it got, but I think it got around those speeds. I think you're right about it cutting off its engines. If the Germans had got the atomic bomb before the United States, they would have probably used the V-2 to launch against Britain. Personally, I think the V-2 was like the beginning. It was the beginning of ICBMs, but I don't think many other countries were really looking into that. I know Germany, their nuclear weapons program, I think it was run by Werner Heisenberg. I've heard things about conspiracy theories and how he actually went out of his way to not let the Nazis get atomic weapons just because they're Nazis and they would probably use it. Well, they would have used it in spite to try to win the war. Also, the V-2, they also had another version of the V-2 called the New York Rocket. It never got into production. I believe in 1943, the British did a raid on the manufacturing plant that produced it. Also, when we talk about the Germans, anybody familiar with German tanks at all? No? Okay. Well, most modern battle tanks are modeled after the Tiger II. The Tiger II was like one of the largest tanks at the time. Pretty much the reason for that was because Adolf Hitler kind of wanted everything in the German army to fit his idea of the powerful German juggernaut. I think it had an 88mm gun, and it outclassed pretty much everything on anything out there for the most part, except. The problem is they had a hard time producing them in mass numbers, which is, another fault with technology on the battlefield. When you start making things so technologically advanced that it's hard to keep them going, you start running into problems, especially if it has environmental problems like the ones that we experienced in Vietnam with the adverse conditions and also in Desert Storm. But the thing was, they couldn't make them fast enough, and the Russians were making their tanks. They were simple. So in this case, the more technologically advanced machine didn't quite withstand to just mass production. Anybody have any... You mean because, I mean, are you saying that they made it simple because they were just trying to do it quickly, or?
Were they worried about manufacturing speed, or what was the, all right, let me ask, was the complexity of the German version an issue of ego? You know, we can make it complicated, so we will. Or was it that they just didn't realize they'd have to crank them out in numbers?
Well, I think at this point in time, the invasion of France had already taken place. At this point, Germany was thinking, they still thought they had a chance. They had lost in Africa, but they thought that their new, more modern, better weapons would give them the edge over the enemy, which it did for a while, until they had tanks starting to break down and weren't able to fix them quite quickly. But I think the Russians were concerned about pumping them out as quickly as possible, just because of the fact that Americans were doing the same way. Because before that, you had, we were giving them tanks in the land lease program, and if they hadn't pumped out tanks, you know, in mass numbers, they wouldn't have been able to keep up, just because of the strength of the Tiger tank. I mean, I can see your point there. I don't know if. The Russians, you know, had a pretty good tank program, before the war really started. But I think it was more or less, let's get more than the Germans can.
It wasn't so much as a point as a question. I mean, did the Germans, did they see themselves as not so vulnerable? I mean, it's a pretty serious blunder to make something so complicated you can't manufacture.
Well, at this point, I think they actually thought that they were going to be able to keep their supply lines open.
They had more time.
Right, they thought that they did, but all of a sudden, here comes the Americans knocking on the back door. You know, and at this point, you know, they were taking some losses, but they still thought they had a chance. Yeah, exactly. This whole Iraq thing. People think the Iraqi military is going to get trounced, which they may well be. They might. Well, you know, I'm not trying to be like political about this or anything. I'll keep my political views out of this one. But if we look at the first Gulf War, you know, they didn't really last too long. But if you make the mistake of walking in and saying, okay, yeah. You know, we're going to win because we have more technology than they do. You have the chance of getting kicked in the groin, so to speak, by the guy in black pajamas with the AK-47. That's like Viet Cong. You know, that's why Vietnam was such a problem. During Vietnam, that's when smart weapons were really getting on the scenes. Like the Maverick missile, the TB-guided missiles. The F-4 was our main, it was like a fighter bomber, it was dual role, but the F-4 was basically doing all of our, tactical strikes. It's hard that the Viet Cong didn't stay still too long. You know, they were always moving. And when you have a small number of people, versus a big number of people, you can take their weaknesses and make them take them to your advantage. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to actually ask what your thoughts were. Do you think using tactical munitions, like taking
What do you think? I mean, are you asking me, do I think it would be more effective?
You think it's more effective
to use tactical strikes?
Yeah, so what's your goal? I mean, well, on a large scale, I mean, you see what's going on now. They're running, you know, hundreds of sorties a day and doing, you know, 1,000.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what it's all about now. Well, anyway, it depends on the situation. Let's say, for instance, there like a column of Iraqi tanks going up this road, and some intelligence source just happens to let us know. In that case, tactical strikes are 100% all the way, just because tactical strikes have the ability to change, you know, last second, like the beginning of the war. This current war with the cruise missile strikes and whatnot, you know, that was a strictly tactical thing. Personally, I don't think that it was supposed to start like that at all. I think that it was just a coincidence, or fate of chance or some intelligence information. But, personally, I would probably go ahead and, try tactical strikes. You know, like one or two aircraft with a couple of missiles isn't going to do the job. You know, maybe a couple, like a four, like four or five F-16s with TV-guided missiles to take out tanks, or ATM Warthog with that cannon the size of a Volkswagen. It depends on certain situations. But like in Vietnam, when we were doing carpet bombing with B-52s. Personally, I think the name of the operation was Linebacker and Linebacker 2. Personally, I think it was okay, but you got to look at who you're fighting. The North Vietnamese weren't like the Germans. The Germans built big walls. You know, we'll build a wall, and the Germans were trying to stop invasions and whatnot. The Vietnamese didn't have that tech. You know, they weren't all about that. They were about being mobile and digging underground. B-52 strikes, I think, did more to strengthen their resolve than to help them, you know, to help us win the war. Like now with the B-52, I think it was good for Afghanistan, because Afghanistan, you know, we're fighting in areas where the terrain is probably not the greatest. And, you know, if you see a large number of troops, yeah, it's probably safer to send one B-52 really high, you know, because in Afghanistan, you don't have to worry about surface air missiles or anything like that. But in Vietnam, Linebacker missions were dangerous. Speaking of Afghanistan, anybody know anything about the Soviet-Afghan War? No? Okay, well, the Soviets liked to invade countries. And Afghanistan was there, so they decided to try to take that over. Basically, the people who we're fighting now were funded by the CIA for the most part. You know, the Mujahideen. Basically, we were on their side because the Soviet Union was the enemy of the United States. You know, all of our major wars after the Second World War have been about communism for the most part. Except the Gulf War and stuff like that, but stopping the spread of communism has been America's goal for almost 50 years. And basically, we didn't go there because I think Jimmy Carter was in office at the time. But you know, we just didn't want to get our noses in that one. But we would, you know, say, "Here's some Stinger missiles." The Stinger missile was absolutely vital in defeating the Soviets. The Stinger missile is a shoulder-fired heat-seeking missile. We gave it's simple. It's very simple. I think pretty much all the major armies use it. So we gave it to the Mujahideen guerrillas, and they learned how to use it pretty quickly. And the Russians were flying Mi-24 attack helicopters. I don't have a picture, but they had the turbines shot out hot air. So if you have a heat-seeking missile, that's your, you know, easy target. So basically, what they would do was it was a good helicopter, but you know, I couldn't hold up against a Stinger. So basically, we were giving them weapons, you know, and we were giving them a lot of help. But here's a picture here of a small Afghani boy with an AK-47. Actually, this is an AK-47 with a folding stock. So it's a Soviet paratrooper. I think Soviet paratroopers would probably end up using that. During the Soviet war, I'm not sure if we were giving them what kind of weapons we were giving them, but they were probably old surplus weapons. You find out that they would take AK-47s. It's like right now that's their weapon of choice. Well, that's pretty much everybody except America's weapon of choice, because in my opinion, I think there's like two kind of weapons in the world. There's American and Soviet bloc weapons, because the Soviets were the gun store for the world, or the weapons market for the world, like come get your weapons here, like the Scud missiles, in Iraq. Are all Soviet missiles. I'm not sure on the range of the Scud, but it's medium range ICBM. In theory, I suppose it could carry. It could carry chemical and biological. I'm not sure about nuclear, but it would only go so far. You know, it's not like a long range weapon. Anybody got any questions or comments? The technological divide was pretty big. The Afghanis, these people had never really fought with modern technology. Like, even when you see now, when we're in Afghanistan, some of these guys, some of the guerrillas, some of the Afghani soldiers weren't really adept about how to operate or in organized fashions. I mean, I'm not saying they were bad fighters, but go ahead. I'm not saying they were bad fighters. They're pretty good. You know, they're fighting for what they think is right. Apparently, some people don't want the Taliban in there. But getting in the helicopter tactics, the airborne tactics, they really didn't know too well. So we had our special forces, the Green Berets and whatnot, go in and teach them how to operate. That's basically what the Green Berets' principal mission is now, helping. Our allies or friendly forces, not necessarily nations, but also guerrilla forces or whatever.
Is part of our problem, especially in Vietnam, that we assume our enemies to be too much like us?
No, I think it's the exact opposite.
We're not prepared. Well, I'm thinking we're not prepared for an enemy who doesn't fight like us.
Well, yeah, I see that point, but see. In Vietnam, we thought they were cavemen in black pajamas. They didn't know anything, didn't know how to fight. You know, every Vietnamese guy was a VC. We forget about the North Vietnamese Army, organized army. They fought the Japanese. They uprised against the Japanese and, with our help, beat them. But we like to underestimate people. We're the Americans, and we think we can, pretty much handle any fight. Unfortunately, that's not true all the time. You know, I'm confident in the American Armed Forces, but, sometimes we make mistakes, like going into places thinking, we'll be in an hour and we'll be out. Like Mogadishu, Somalia. Anybody remember that? 1990, I think it was 1994 or 93, Clinton administration. Mohammed Farah-Adid, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Mohammed Farah-Adid, Black Hawk Down. Okay, this warlord, Mohammed Farah-Adid. Basically, Somalia, starving country. Time magazine did like a little run-up in America. All the Western countries got outraged really quickly. So that's like the trend. Nobody cared about it until it was in Time magazine. It got all important. And the warlord didn't like that very much. We were, he held his power by basically means of food and whatnot. And he was a pretty powerful guy. And we decided to go in with special forces after the Marines went for a while first. And they left, and then some UN workers got killed, and we decided to go in and take the guy out. We had a hard time doing that. We hired some informants. Didn't pan out. basically, what ended up happening was we ended up having a great big mess. We ended up trying to find out where he was at. Apparently, they thought he was at the Hotel Olympia, I believe it was, in downtown Mogadishu. And they decided to send in, I think it was Rangers, Hua, yeah, Rangers, and Delta Force. And, you know, those are pretty, really, really competent soldiers. But we were thinking it would be in and out in 25 minutes, 30 minutes tops. They had Black Hawk helicopters and small helicopters. I forget what they're called. Those really small. Remember the A-Team, Magnum PI, how they had that really small helicopter? No, it was in a UE. Yeah, you know what I'm talking. It was kind of like that. But anyway, the small ones landed Special Forces on the roof. They landed Delta on the roof of the Olympia Hotel, and they went in and captured prisoners, and everything was looking good. And they had a lightly armored column. Actually, it was just a bunch of Humvees and cloth top truck. So they got the prisoners. They were there. Everything was fine. The Special Forces were supposed to, the Army Rangers roped in on the four corners of the hotel and held the ground. And all of a sudden, things started going wrong. And thousands and thousands, over 1,000, well over 1,000. I'm pretty sure it was up to maybe 1,000 to 2,000 people at one point, maybe even more than that. And basically, the fire got heavy. And then a guy came out with an RPG, rocket-propelled grenade, and put one through a Black Hawk. It was a Black Hawk. I forget who the pilot was. But one Black Hawk went down, and it went down in the middle of the city. And everybody's way away. So now they have to go get that pilot out. But the pilot, unfortunately, died in the crash. But one of the crew chiefs was still alive. I think two of them were alive. So basically what went wrong there is we underestimated the enemy. The enemy, we thought, yeah, they're a bunch of skinny guys. They don't know how to shoot. They shoot wildly. And they were dead wrong. After September 11th, I don't know how true this is, but there were, Somalia is Islamic, is a heavily, well, most of Africa is like heavily Islamic country, and from what I understand, Al-Qaeda trained them and gave them some weapons, because, why wouldn't Al-Qaeda need a warlord in a certain place or two? So, the Black Hawk went down. We tried to secure one Black Hawk. Another Black Hawk went down went down on the other side of the city. So you had two Black Hawk downs, two sides of the city, and they're pretty much stranded by themselves. In Black Hawk number two, the pilot was Mike Durant. He became a prisoner of war for like 5 days. So basically what happened, they tried to rescue them, but they couldn't get there because they were held down in heavy fire. And they were taking lots of wounded. So, a long story short, some Delta Force tried to rope in. Two Delta Force snipers roped in, Gary Gordon and some other guy. I forget his name. And they tried to protect the pilot. The two guys that tried to protect the pilot end up dying by the Somalians. They took the pilot captive. He was captive for 5 days. But the lesson to be, well, it took the United Nations to come in to save us. There was some Indian regiment that had some APCs, armored personnel carriers, near, and they drove from a stadium that was near our base to exfiltrate the people. Sorry about that. Yeah, thank you. I'm just going to let his ring in my jacket pocket. Anyway, they tried to get them out, and they exfiltrated them, but they were there for about a day. I think it lasted for a little over 24 hours. Shut up.
So is it necessarily technology, or is it ego?
It's a little bit of both. See, Why do we have a big ego? Because we have a lot of technology. Because we think that our technology will save us.
We don't learn.
We're doomed to make the same mistakes, underestimating the enemy, thinking that our superior technology will help, will save the day. But it ends up not only hampering us, but after Vietnam, the American public didn't want a lot of casualties, so that's why our technology turned to standoff weapons.
You said you're drawing some correlation between people with not a lot of technology going up against a lot of technology, and just the fundamental differences. And right now, it looks like we're facing something where we're fighting people that the soldiers really don't value their own lives at all.
Yeah. Right, right.
Do you think we can adequately defeat something like that?
Defeat suicide bombing?
Well, if somebody's in for their life, right, has no regard for human life.
Yes, we can. Vietnam, we had Hearts and Minds campaign. We could do that again. I don't know how well it's going to work. But look at World War II. It's the Japanese kamikaze pilots. You know, by the way, the Japanese weren't like the only people doing kamikaze missions. The Germans, when they were losing in the on the Soviet front, they modified ME-109s to fly and crash into bridges. So they were trying to. So it wasn't just the Japanese. But when you face a suicidal, fanatical enemy, you got to brace for the worst. People will die because. They will go out of their way to kill you. Go.
Was it the comet that had
the landing? I think it's ME-262. Is it?
It was a 163.
Yeah, there you go.
It was a little rocket powered.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. No, it had no landing gear. It had skids. It had the belly land. It's very dangerous. They stopped using it. It had some sort of liquid fuel propellant that was toxic to the pilots, so the pilots were flying this. They had to breathe bottled oxygen, but the thing had a bad reputation for exploding when you land. So
if there was any fuel left in the tank when you landed, it can slosh around and accidentally mix.
Yeah, it explodes. So
why not just accidentally land in the enemy?
I see the Germans. I think a lot of Germans. Like to live. I mean, everybody likes to live. But I think a lot of Germans at the time the end of the war was coming, they were fed up. And the only thing they were trying to do is keep the Americans as far away from Berlin as possible. But, what was the question I was answering? Fanatical enemy. In World War II, the Japanese were fanatical. Crazy fanatical. Not only kamikaze pilots, but the people on the ground digging in, like in Iwo Jima, tunnels so deep. It got to the point where the Japanese people... In the war, their conditions were so horrible that they were actually killing each other. When people died, they were so thirsty they had no water that they would lick the sweat off of each other's backs. They would drink. They got to the point where they were drinking each other's urine. And they were when people died, they actually slit their wrists and drank the blood because they were so thirsty. That's how deplorable the conditions were. And when you have people that are that willing to fight, yeah, you can't win. I mean, you can win, but it's gonna be hard and people will die. What, killing each other and drinking? Yeah. Yeah. See, you can talk. I mean, Geneva Convention exists, but, I'd like to think the United States follows the Geneva Convention, but, it's kind of. I mean, I'm not saying that it's hard to follow the Geneva Convention, it's pretty straightforward, but people just sometimes forget the rules. Like the thing, not showing prisoners on TV, I think that's, personally, if I was a prisoner of war, I'd like people to know that I was still alive. But, as long as it's not like beating prisoners of war. Like in Somalia, after they killed the two Black Hawk, the two crew chiefs out of the second Black Hawk, they tied them up and they tied them to boards and they dragged them to the street and they had people kicking them. And so that was pretty bad and a direct violation of the Geneva Convention. But fanatical enemy, I'm pretty sure it's possible to defeat a fanatical enemy if you try hard enough. And let's not try to make them so fanatical. Let's try to, like in Vietnam, the Green Berets would go into villages and say, yo, we're nice, you know? Please don't kill us. We like you. You know, we're just here to liberate your country. I'm not going to use the word liberate, but we're here to help with stuff. Fanatical enemy is a pretty tough thing. But, what?
I love the mental picture, just, you know, he walks into a village with a rifle and goes, yo, we're nice. You know, don't shoot us.
You knew a really dumb pig's gun in the street.
Yeah, you know, don't mind the heavy armor.
Yeah. See, inherently, people are afraid of the military because they have guns and explosives and stuff. And people, people got guns, you know, you just don't go, you know, waltzing up to them. But, yeah. Exactly. As far as a fanatical enemy, it would take lots of time. Do I think the Iraqis are fanatical? I think some of them are, some of them aren't. You got to make the distinction between the guy who's forced to fight and the guy who wants to be there and who's hardcore about it. Because the guy who's hardcore about it, inherently everybody wants to live. But, some people will go out of their way to make sure, if they have a cause far enough. Like, I don't personally understand suicide bombings too much. I mean, I understand the concept, yeah. It's like the suicide bombings is like inspiration to other people and, you know, killing some people. But my thing is, if you want to change things and if you want to carry out attacks, even if it's guerrilla attacks, fight the military. Don't go to bus stations and blow yourself up. Fight the military, you know. Blow up your, I mean, you know, do something against the military. Like the World Trade Center, that was deplorable. But, hit a military target if you want to do something. But I can understand wanting to do something to the economy, but, you know.
Okay. The military civilian diplomatic distinction, what if they hit the United Nations? Acceptable target?
No, not military. I wouldn't call the United Nations a military target, you know? You know what I mean? Because it's not exactly a military target. I would say that's more of a civilian forum. Yeah, it's representative of countries, but I understand. But hit the country's barracks or something like that.
But if you know you can't defeat them militarily, you fall back.
Yeah, you fight the civilians, and I think that you're gonna do that, but that's inherently immoral in my. Yeah, go ahead.
The UN might be a military target if you are at war with the UN.
But how can...
Since most countries are a part of the UN, that's just like bombing your own White House.
Yeah. Sort of. I could sort of see UN as a military target, but not really. Let's see. Anybody got anything that they'd like to know? That I haven't talked about? Anything that they'd like to know?
You mentioned that a smaller force has to oppose a larger force at their weak points.
What, say again?
You mentioned that when a smaller force opposes a larger force, it must oppose the weak points with the strong points.
Exactly.
And one of the strong points of a smaller group as opposed to a larger group is that they can hit more vulnerable.
Yeah, and quicker and faster. Well, okay.
To cause the entire army to fear to fight is, for a guerrilla force, the whole reason of existence. That's what they do. Which, as deplorable as you find it, that's what September 11th was. That's what most guerrilla tactics are.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. I see your point, but I don't know what exactly to say about that. But like in Vietnam, the North Vietnamese had a thing about popping up out of nowhere. You know, all of a sudden you got like a bunch of G.I. Joes walking around, everything's cool, you know, chilling. And then all of a sudden, you got like a bunch of Vietnamese coming out of nowhere, like out of nowhere, out of thin air. And that's what they're for. You know, guerrilla forces are there to harass and harass the enemy. But as far as September 11th, I don't know if I want to like really debate the World Trade Center as a military target. As a target of significance, maybe I can understand, but you know, that's kind of like a touchy subject, and I don't know what I would say about that. Personally, my own personal feeling, I think that that does not justify a military target, but they're terrorists, so you know, that's a thing. Yeah, go ahead. Absolutely. Absolutely. Do we know for a fact? I mean, in this scenario, do we know for 100% fact?
Yeah. Let's say he used a nuke over in his own country on our forces.
Yeah. Is it okay for us to use nuclear weapons?
Would it be? Yeah.
Would it be? Does it kill American soldiers? Yeah. If he uses nuclear weapons and it kills American soldiers, I say that it is okay to use small yield tactical nuclear devices on military targets. I'm not the guy. Personally, I don't like the idea of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Personally, because it was just like too many civilians hurt in that. But what? Oh, okay. Anyway, you know, I can understand the reasons, because not invading Japan, like the fanatical enemy, Japan, I think I don't think they would have fought to the last breath, but at some point they would have given up, but a lot of people would have died. But why two bombs? Why two bombs? Now, I've heard some people say that it's the Japanese only thought that we might had the capability to produce one of these weapons. I've heard that argument, but
we wanted to try.
Yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. I think we understood because we detonated one.
Yes, we detonated one. The test, the radioactive test at the time.
Yeah, but say again. Yeah. Yeah, does anybody know the radioactive effects at those sites now?
No. I know there are radioactive areas in there.
Off limits?
There's areas that are closed regularly due to radioactive substances in the air.
Okay,
why is the Trinity site open to tourists? Because it's an open air and there is not very much radioactive material.
Parks, and you're not there for long.
Actually, you can visit the...
Yeah, I've seen that.
That building was a ground zero.
Yeah, and that's the only thing that is left standing.
Memorial at ground zero.
Yeah. Okay, let's see here.
I would argue that Hiroshima and Nagasaki were targets of military significance.
How so?
They were
port cities?
No, there were civilians in them.
Too many civilians. Yeah, true. And a lot of those civilians worked at war production factories. Which probably makes them military. Okay, let's say in the United States, let's say for theoretically, Germany invaded Canada. And
finally!
Yeah, so the Nazis invade Canada, and there's a plant, some armament plant in Detroit, and they bomb it, and there's a bunch of civilians working there. Are those civilians? Hey, are you talking about the City of Rivers? I live there, so let's not use that example.
Oh. That was a military target. In fact, that's
okay.
Where Nike missile launchers on Belle Isle.
What, during the Cold War?
Yes.
Okay.
But Detroit it's a major manufacturing.
Yeah, there's Nike silos like all over the area.
Yeah.
Is it a
large target? Anyway, okay. Wait, so are those people considered military targets? I mean, are those people specific? I'm not talking about the plant, but the people who work there. Yes or no?
Well, they're on the site. Yes, if they're your
I guess so. I don't know what the Geneva Convention would say about that, but I don't know. Say again? What? What?
Not the workers of plant food functions.
Yes. So, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was kind of unfortunate, but especially the fire bombings. Horrible, horrible. But see, now with precision guiding, like, that's one thing technology is good for, saving some civilian lives, I'm not saying that it's 100, smart weapons are 100%. Like what? The Patriot missile. Way to kill, you know, killing our British allies with a Patriot missile. Did anybody hear about that? Yeah, yeah, I know, IFF. Identify friend foe.
Have you seen the AC-130 gunship video?
No.
You haven't seen that one?
No.
I'm not exactly sure where to find it. I found it through a Google search. But it's video of a Hercules cargo plane refitted with artillery shelling a Taliban compound in Afghanistan. And the precision was great enough that they were chasing guys down with 40-millimeter shells.
Oh, wow.
It's like the guy's running, and then he's not.
He's like a white
girl. Yeah. They got a thermal scope. They're flying at like 5 minutes.
Oh, jeez. That's...
If you can find it, just look for like the AC-130 gunship.
Anyway, this is the AK-47 I was talking about. That's like the you know... Actually, that's an airsoft AK-47, which you can buy, which is pretty cool. Yeah. No, it shoots plastic pellets. No, not the real. Anyway, anybody interested in nuclear submarines? All right. Anybody know anything about Soviet subs? What movie is that? Red October. Anyway, anybody know anything about K-19? I think it was K-19, the first Soviet nuclear-powered intercontinental ballistic missile sub, Boomer. I think NATO designates all ballistic missile subs as Boomers. Yeah, it was a nickname. Well, I don't know where it came from. Did NATO give it to it or? Anyway, I think if I'm not mistaken, I believe the K-19 was a hotel class submarine. Basically, the Soviets were trying to meet us when it came to missile technologies on submarines, because our first nuclear submarine was the Nautilus, which was the first submarine that reached North Pole, I believe. Anyway, the Soviets, you know, they had the nuclear bomb, and they were trying to catch up with us with nuclear technology. So basically, somebody had an idea to put a nuclear reactor in a submarine, which is a pretty good idea. Because the German diesel subs were awesome. The Germans had the Type 22 U-boat, which was basically, from what I perceive, this is my personal opinion. I think that the Type 22 was like one of the beginning was like one of the main reasons why subs went nuclear, because the Type 22 was actually the first real extended stay submarine. It was still diesel, but you know, it was built to support men for extremely long missions. There's only one of them left, and it's somewhere in Germany. And the Type 7C U-boat was the standard U-boat. And most during the Second World War, the Germans used Wolfpack tactics, and it worked quite effectively against us, especially during the East Coast Operation Drumbeat, also known in German, I think it's Hockenschlag, something like that. Drumbeat. Operation Drumbeat was the German plan to attack American shipping. Going to the British Isles. Basically, Britain was being starved by the U-boats because they were sinking ships at an enormous, alarming rate. So America's like, we better help this. We better stop this. But the second that the United States declared war on Pearl Harbor, the Germans also declared war on us, which Some people say it's foolish, but I say they were allies with Japan, and that's their job, you know. So basically what was going on was after this, the U-boats had a free rein to attack anything in the water. So Admiral Karl Dönitz, the leader of the German U-boat arm, and later became Reich Chancellor right before the end of the war, he decided to send, I think the number was around anywhere from, I'm not sure if it was 7 or 12, but he sent 7 or 12 U-boats to the east coast of America, from everywhere from New York to Texas, and they were detected, believe it or not, because Karl Dönitz liked to talk to people. He got lonely at night, so he would get his Enigma, and he would start typing messages to his U-boat captains. And the British knew where to find him because of triangulation. So while Dönitz was like lonely and wanted to talk, basically the British were triangulating, and they knew where they were at. And they were like, you know, they called the United States Navy intelligence and said, "You got so many U-boats heading your way. You should do something about it." But Admiral King, which was an American admiral over the Atlantic Fleet at the time, he didn't care. He thought he hated English people for some reason. But basically, we got raped. We just got raped. They were sinking ships at such an alarming rate that the government actually stopped newspapers from reporting it in Texas. They were sinking ships unopposed. I forget the name of the captain, so I won't try to guess. But anyway, this U-boat captain was around Coney Island, and they had the lights on. And he's like, "We can make out our targets just fine." He said we were so close that we could smell the pine needles, and we could hear the amusement park. So basically, they had free rein. And that's where modern ballistic missile submarines got their tactics, because of the U-boats parking off the coast of America or Russia, whatever side you're on, and sitting there for extended periods of time. And when you get the heads up from Moscow or Washington, launch your nuclear weapons. Anyway, K-19 was built for that purpose. The K-19 was on a training mission. Basically, it was to test a missile. So it completed its training missile fine. But the thing is, there was a coolant leak on the main reactor. And the main reactor basically was losing coolant pressure. So what they had to do was they had to send somebody in to fix it. And the temperature was rising, and they were close to meltdown, and it was pretty dangerous. Anybody see K-19, the movie? Some of that was wrong. Like, there was no American destroyer shattering them. That was pure Hollywood, yeah. They were out there by themselves, totally by themselves. Basically, the thing about fixing the nuclear reactor with water from their regular water circuit. So basically what they did, they took fuel out of torpedoes. I mean, they took the pipes out of torpedoes and welded them together. And they welded it from their water systems all the way to the nuclear reactor. So somebody had to go and go to the nuclear reactor weld it in there. And the nuclear reactor at the time is highly radioactive. So they didn't have nuclear suits. They had chemical suits. Yeah. Basically, they were wearing raincoats. Hold on, I got something here. They also had these. This is like Soviet gas mask. And they had oxygen containers, so, you know, they could breathe clean oxygen. But basically, they were pretty much sentenced to die, but it was for the good of the crew. So they figured out a way to get water to the coolant system. So people had to go in and weld it. The people who did the welding repairs died within, I think, the longest person that lived, I think it was about a couple months, I think. I can't verify that for sure. But K-19 limped back home. Basically, it tried, the captain's name was not, I forget the name of the captain in the movie, but that's not his real name. And the two captain thing, how they had 5 minutes, 10 minutes? Okay, they did not have two captains. That was not true either. But anyway, basically, they decided that there were diesel submarines in the area, so the diesel submarines saved K-19. But they did not submerge to fix the leak. They stayed on the surface, and they fixed the leak without incident. But the people died of radioactivity. Most of them died of radioactivity. Let's see. Also, anybody know where the Saturn V came from? Nobody. Okay. Anyway, it came from the Germans. The guy who invented the V2. What? Yeah. Anyway, the guy who invented the V2 is, in my opinion, solely responsible for the Apollo project. He invented the Saturn V rocket, and he was the one who figured out how to actually get there, because they were thinking about doing docking some several different ways. Let's talk about aircraft. Aircraft, okay. All right, anybody familiar with military aircraft? Let's talk about the Korean War. During the beginning of the Korean War, we were kind of outclassed. The MiG-15 came out. The British decided to give the Russians their Rolls-Royce jet engine. They said, hey, I think Russia and Britain will be friends for a long time. So here, you can have this new jet engine. So they gave them the jet engine, and they took that jet engine and pretty much copied it and put it into the MiG-15. The MiG-15 was the first... Delta Wing jet ever. And we had P-51 prop-driven aircraft. And we were getting decimated for a little while. But the North Koreans had a little secret. Some of the people flying for the North Koreans were actually Russians. They weren't only training them, but they were actually Soviets flying the planes. See, the Soviets are solely responsible for much of the arming of our enemies. So it goes both ways. But it was a sweat-wing fighter. And to counter that, we came out with the F-86. The F-86 was a sweat-wing fighter also, and it was pretty slick. It was nice. Our kill ratio was pretty good. Because we were mostly using guns. During Vietnam, how many? 5 minutes? Okay. During Vietnam, we had the F-4 versus the MiG-21. The MiG-21 Foxbat was pretty good. It was also a sweat-wing fighter. We had Soviet pilots fighting for the North Koreans. But the thing was, it was a maneuverable aircraft, and it had decent radar systems, but the North Koreans would fight, but when the going got rough, they would fly to China. They would fly to China, and that was out of our engagement area, so we couldn't chase them. They got away home free. I'm going to have to wrap it up, so... I got a question, and I got a prize for somebody who can answer it. I got a East German garrison hat here. All right, let's see. Can someone name at least two modern, at least one American heavy, two American heavy bombers and one Soviet heavy bomber? Anybody want to try that? Here you go. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, that's pretty much the end of my speech. Hope you enjoy Rubicon, and if you got any questions, I'll be here for a while. All right, that's it.